Well, I hope I don't get my visa to Pepper Pike lifted after this morning. Actually, I expropriated the title, appropriated it. Dr. Kenneth Keniston, who is professor of psychiatry at Yale University Medical School, and one of the most perceptive commentators on the current human scene. Some months ago, he published an article which he entitled, "You Have to Grow Up in Scarsdale to Know How Bad Things Really Are." And of course, he was not pointing to any one incident in Scarsdale, though I suppose there are many incidents there, but rather to the fact that Scarsdale, like Pepper Pike, like Gates Mills, like Bay Village, this community of the well-to-do, of the nearly well-to-do, of those who like to be around the well-to-do, and that it is what's called euphemistically in our books of sociology a homogeneous class of economic structure. And that one bit of evidence that comes out of these communities is this, that a disproportionate number of the young activists, the young revolutionaries of our day come from these homes. Homes and communities which have provided every opportunity that the most affluent and indulgent society known to man can provide. These young people were born with a silver spoon in their mouths. They were carefully bundled off to nursery school at just the right age, to just the right school. These communities have been terribly concerned, the youngsters would say uptight, about having just the right kind of public school and just enough private school facilities for just the right children. They have been given trips at just the right age around the country and at just the right time to Europe. They've been given music lessons and drama lessons, and they've been taken to just the right symphonies and to just the right theaters. Everything has been done, which could possibly be done, to give these young people the opportunity which was denied to Caesar's sons. Now, it turns our world upside down when we find that revolutionaries are born and nurtured in this kind of surrounding. There's still something startling about seeing young men and young women going off to the revolution in $6,000 sports cars. We expect the revolution among the dispossessed, the denied, the frustrated, those who are forced to stand outside the society, its doors are shut to them. There's richness and opportunity inside, but they are in the cold and in the chill. That's where we expect revolution to be born. But here we have it nurtured and growing in the very center, the very heart of the establishment. And you've heard it. You've heard it from your own children. You've heard it from the children of friends. Junior begins with a long chronicle of the ills of our society. It's a bleak tale, a desperate tale. There's nothing that's any good. Everything falls short. Society is conspiring against the individual. And father will say, well, where is it better? Is it better in Russia? Is it better in Cuba? Is it better in North Vietnam? And junior will sort of shrug his shoulders as if father hasn't understood what he's been talking about. And father, out of desperation, will begin the long, sad, and true tale of how in the last 50 or 75 years the United States has had an economic revolution of triumphant proportions, how we have taken the economic pyramid and turned it on its point so that the many have been given major parts of the abundance of the nation. And he'll say how in his childhood he remembers the company town and the company store, 60-hour week, the vestiges of the sweatshop, the strikes that were just at the beginning of unionization. How much has happened? What a great performance, what a great reformist track record America has. And Junior will shrug. He'll say, you haven't understood a word I've said. This is a cold world. It's a world which conspires against the individual. You can't be a person in this great economic triumph you seem to be talking about. They're talking on different planes. The youngster, of course, has been granted every advantage of the economic revolution that the fathers and the grandfathers brought about. And the grandfathers and the fathers simply cannot understand what looks to them as ingratitude, an unawareness of the major triumphs in American life these past decades. And so we see at Berkeley, Columbia, Harvard, young people provided everything, who are now being provided the opportunity to do whatever they want to in the richest society the world has ever known, who stand at the very threshold of incredible freedoms, incredible opportunities, turning bitterly against their society, denouncing it for every evil, every conceivable evil in the litany of the Crusaders. What have we? How shall we explain it? What have we here? Now, the young people like to explain the youth revolution, their activism, their contempt of the society, their cry, tear it down, let's begin again, as catalyzed and motivated by the very real evils in the social structure. They point to an archaic welfare system. They point to the 20, 25 million who still must survive somehow below the poverty line. They point to the war in Vietnam. They point to the many unfortunate moments in our international policy. And they say, this is the reason that we are rebelling. This is the reason that we are activists. And there's substantive truth to their charges. There's some very terrible ills and evils still in our body politic. These evils have always been there. In every generation, there have been the poor, unfortunately, and the abused, unfortunately. And America has never had a visionary welfare program. And our cities have never been secure, places without violence. And our foreign policy has had its Spanish-American wars and its Korean wars, quite as much as its involvements in Vietnam. There have always been substantive reasons for the youth to rebel, but they haven't always rebelled. And so if we want to understand this rebellion, and the reason this begins particularly in the more affluent, better educated elements in our society, we have to look elsewhere. But let nothing I say this morning minimize the fact that the complaints of the young people have many of them validity, and that it is our basic purpose to solve the social problems and the political problems which confront us. But I'd like to look at this question psychologically and sociologically and see if another perspective may not be of advantage to us. Now, those who are psychologically oriented tend to explain the youth revolution in terms of the traditional rumblings and rebellion of the adolescent against the father image, against mother, against authority. And they say that what happens simply is that the youth sees on the mistakes and the failures of mother and father and of their generation to provide substance, to give rational validity to an emotional rebellion which must in any case take place. The rebellion is inchoate, it's emotional, it's undifferentiated, and they find justification in the ills of the society at large. And of course, there is such a thing as adolescent rebellion. We must turn against the family to a certain degree, turn against the lifestyle of our home in order to find ourselves and our own way of doing things, who we are and where we're going. But adolescent rebellion is not a new thing. It existed in the last generation, in the generation before. And there was no youth rebellion the proportions that we have it today. You can't explain simply on the basis of the churning of young people, the need to turn against the authority figures of their society. You can't explain, in my estimation, what's happening today. Or perhaps the young people are turning against a generation of parents who are more hypocritical, less involved than any other in our history. Well, that's nonsense. Every generation has had its good citizens, every generation of those who have been careless of their responsibilities. No more, no less, I'm sure. But perhaps the young people are turning against the hypocrisy of their parents. Because one of the interesting statistics which comes out of the studies of the homes in Pepper Pike and in Bay Village and in Gates Mills is that by and large they are more liberal and more concerned with social change than the homes in Parma or in Euclid, the homes which are not producing the young rebels. Perhaps the young people are simply acting out the profession of their parents. Their parents talk, and they put their bodies where the parents' talk seems to be intended. But many parents don't simply talk. Many of the parents in these homes are the men and the women who built solidly the economic reforms of this generation and the last, who have been involved since their early years in all kinds of programs designed for the national interest. And there is no statistical evidence which would lead us to believe that there is more rebelliousness, more radicalism in the homes in which the parents are verbal but not active than the homes in which the parents are both verbal and active. I'd like to suggest a different kind of explanation. And I take my explanation from a very interesting piece of social research done by a French historian named Philippe Ariès. Monsieur Ariès has studied the family as it developed through history. And he has pointed to a phenomenon that I think no one else really saw until this pioneering work. It's startling in that we never think in these terms. Let the idea grow on you. He suggests this in his book called Childhood Through the Centuries. That childhood is a relatively recent phenomenon in human history. That until 200 years ago, with the exception of the very few at the top of any society, the kings, the nobles, the sheikhs, and the Caesars, their sons and daughters, no one had a childhood. Babies were born, and they were allowed 4 or 5 or 6 years to toddle around and to play. They were given freedom and a great deal of security. They were fed and clothed and swaddled. And then by the time they were 5 or 6 or 7, they were immediately put to work. The boys apprenticed to the plow, the girls in the farmyard scrubbing the floor or raising the younger children. No one talked of schooling. By far the vast majority of people who have ever lived, 90% or more, have been illiterate. No one thought of this kind of opportunity, because what we needed was simple physical brute manpower and womanpower. And so there was the child and the worker. At no stage, the infant and the worker, no stage called childhood in between. Now, Dr. Ariès contends that childhood begins at about the time that the Industrial Revolution begins. That as men learn to put machines to use machines to produce a flood of goods, to produce more goods from the same acre, more grain from the same acre, men no longer needed the vast reserves of manpower and womanpower they had needed before. There were now machines. And men needed a much more technical skill on the part of people. They had a cipher to read and to write, to be the clerks, to be the bookkeepers, to be the people who managed the estates, people who were now needed in the economic order. Now childhood begins. There was sufficient surplus capital in the family to allow the child not to be a member of the workforce, not to bring in a sense, a paycheck until he was 10 or 12. Until that time, the family could support him. Then he was sent out. And so the mass of the people began to receive at least that education which taught them to read and to write and to cipher. And as there were more machines and the machines became more complex, and as the society became more abundant, sixth grade education was no longer sufficient. Then there was a 10th grade education, a high school diploma, which became the universal basic need. And now, as the years progressed in which people were afforded childhood, we went beyond that point, which is puberty, into that era which we call adolescence, where emotionally and physiologically and physically, the child was no longer really simply a child. He was a child man. He was half child, half man. And we got ourselves into a world where all kinds of complex tensions suddenly erupted into the home. When the child at age 10 was set out to be a worker, apprenticed out of the home, the tensions between the apprentice in some shop miles away and the home simply disappeared. The child swam or he sank. Most sank. But it was not the responsibility of the parent. If you look into the Talmud, you find that the only thing the Talmud really says that the parent is obliged to do is to feed his child, provide him a roof and clothing, and provide him with a skill. The emotional tensions, which most of us instinctively associate with the raising of children, because these are the realities of raising people through puberty and adolescence, simply didn't take place in most ancient homes, because the children weren't under the roof during those years. Or if they were, they were in a different relationship, one which gave them a certain leverage, because they did work which was otherwise required. But now, as we required a high school diploma, we provided the young people with an education which broadened their horizons, taught them of other values besides the folk ways, the ancient privileges and ancient prejudices of their family, creating by our educational systems tension, the tension perhaps which liberates, but tension nonetheless. We helped them to come to skills beyond the skills of their parents and their grandparents. For the first time in history, parents felt inferior intellectually to their offspring. They felt they didn't understand the world their offspring were going to move into. And we created a world in which a parent was assumed to be responsible, legally and otherwise, for a 17-year-old whose actions he could no longer control, physically or emotionally. Over the last century, beginning first in the more affluent sections of a society, then spreading throughout the society, we've had to come to grips with an understanding of adolescent-parent relationships, child-parent relationships, as we tended to call them, during some very, very difficult years. And little by little, we created techniques to allow the child to be partially in the home, partially free, to have certain kinds of responsibilities, but not others. And the child of 15 and 16 was still sufficiently dependent upon the parent's judgment, sufficiently a child emotionally, that he did not rebel totally against this kind of situation. So far, Mr. Arias, I'd like to suggest that in the last two generations, we've added still another dimension to, in quotation marks, childhood. And that's what we're suffering from and suffering through today. What have we seen since the Second World War? We've seen an explosion of knowledge, of learning, of the responsibility of children on a mass basis to go to college and beyond college to go to graduate school. We've no longer require the 18-year-old, the 19-year-old, the 20-year-old in the workforce. And we require of the brightest of these young people a sophisticated, specialized skill which they cannot acquire unless they spend years and years beyond the high school level in great centers of learning, where they can master the far reaches of learning. But now we're dealing with young people who are hardly children and hardly half child, half adult. They're fully grown. A rabbi sees this conflict, this trauma again and again. A mother will come into my office, and she'll say, "I don't know what to do about Johnny. He just won't do his work. He won't buckle down. He's getting poor grades. He won't listen to me. He's in the outer office. I'd like you to talk to him." And Johnny turns out to be 220 pounds, 20 years old, bearded, capable of having fathered two or three children, capable of having earned his own living for many years. But mother thinks of him as a child. And there's everything in the relationship to confirm her point of view. Father still sponsors Junior. He pays his bills, he pays for his car, he pays for his tuition, he pays for his trips home. And father still assumes that if Junior gets into trouble, it's father's responsibility to bail him out. And mother's still in the position that you'd be with a nursery school child. Teacher calls up, he's getting poor grades, you go to school to find out what you can do. But you can't sit down with a 20-year-old and do his homework for him. Because in part, you won't understand the kind of physics or chemistry that he's trying to do. What we have now is a society, primarily at this point still in the Scarsdales and the Pepper Pikes and the Bay Villages, but a society which will, a group which will grow as the response, the needs of the economic order grow, which provides for its young people every educational opportunity, even unto the late 20s. And because the young person is not fully productive, it does not allow, the society does not allow either the young person or the parent to assume that the parenting relationship is over. That is not to say that the family has been disbanded, but it is to say that the responsibility of the parent for the manipulation and the management of the life of this young person is still assumed. And no 20-year-old will accept that, even if they need it. And no parent can enforce this, even if it is needed. And that, I submit, is part of the real crux of the problem. A 20-year-old is not a child. And your 20-year-old is not, in this sense, your child. But nothing in our society makes it possible for you or for the 20-year-old to assume that the father, son, mother, daughter, parent, child relationship is essentially over. Everything, in fact, conspires to make you feel that you are somehow still responsible. Grades at universities are still sent home, amazingly, 1969. As if mother must sign Junior's report card. We still assume that we ought to really dish out learning to a 19 and 20 and 21-year-old and worry about motivation, worry about their wanting to learn, as though that's our responsibility any longer. It's theirs. It's their life. They're either going to have the skills or they're not going to have the skills. They're either going to make out or they're not going to make out, and nothing we do as parent or as professor who tries to be in locus parentis is going to change that. But we mollycoddle, because we're still caught in the image of what high school really was like. And our universities are in many ways just overgrown high schools. Everyone is going, and we've not said to the young person, work your way through, or make up your own mind while you're there, or do it. We worry still, did you practice 30 minutes today? Did you get your English theme in on time? There comes a point, and most parents in Pepper Pike and in Scarsdale and Bay Village and in Gates Mills and elsewhere in the nation have not yet come to that point, when parenting ceases, when you've got to say, Bocher, you're on your own. Sink or swim. I love you, but... That's what we find terribly, terribly difficult to do. Because we find it difficult to do, because we enmesh ourselves and these young people with silken strings, they feel constrained. We feel frustrated. They feel that there's a great big world out there seething with problems, seething with opportunity, and they're marching off to class with their little notebooks to take the class notes on Greek history between 312 and 186 before the Common Era. They know they'll forget this. They'll say to you, perhaps in all honesty, why can't I leave school? And you'll have a very serious conversation about the draft in which neither of you will have the courage to say, why not drop out of school and be drafted? It's not the worst thing that ever happened. Why not take your chances? If you're in school, and you want school, and you're learning something from school, and it's useful to you, by all means, do it. If not, go some other way. There are many roads which lead to your goal. But we see only the road of education, only the road which the Scarsdales and the Pepper Pikes and the Shaker Heightses and the Cleveland Heightses have had as a fixation for so many years. Now, there's a real world out there. In the sense, we're keeping these young people from that real world. We haven't created an educational system, for instance, which would allow them to learn and to do at the same time, which would allow them to have their class opportunities, but at the same time, to be part of that larger world. How many children say to me, I really wanted to work this summer, but father said, how many years have I got, and I ought to spend it in Europe. But what child isn't going to go to Europe? I'm sorry, what young person isn't going to go to Europe? But they're not going to know what work is. Father says, oh, it's all right, I'll pay the bills. Don't worry, you don't have to earn so much money. But they do have to earn money because they're earning self-respect. They're earning their right to be responsible for their own lives. And when you're not responsible for your life, you flail. Get very angry, very bitter, and often very destructive in your bitterness. I began by saying that there's some very basic social problems. It goes without saying. One thing we've learned in dealing with the welfare problems of our day and with the social service problems of our day and with the inner city problems of our day is that one of the things you can do is to take people without high school degrees, sometimes without an eighth grade education, and train them on the job for certain kinds of responsibilities. You don't always need a piece of paper in order to do a particular task. What you need is the responsibility, a desire to do it. But why can't we find ways in which to structure, we and our young adults, or our adults, to structure the 18s and the 20s and the 22s and the 24s so that they can operate in the world and yet learn? Was NYU and CCNY so bad for all those young Jewish fathers of ours who worked all day and went to school in the late evening? Where was it said to Moses on Mount Sinai that you had to go to school week in and week out as a full-time education to take 5 hours of classroom instruction, 7 hours, the average length of work in class of the average child? For some, yes. For those who know exactly where they want to go and how they're going to get there and what they're going to do, by all means. But one of the interesting statistics that have come out of the studies of the youngest of the radicals and the most radical groups is this, that they come precisely from those areas in the university where they do not have any idea of where they're going or why. The chemist knows he's going into chemistry. That's why he's taking chemistry. He's rarely wasting semester after semester in the writing pronunciamentos about the overthrow of the nation. It's in the liberal arts, in the soft social sciences, where you're being taught really how to read intelligently the New York Times, that much of our restlessness is coming from. God bless the restlessness if we can channel it, if we can use it constructively. God bless their criticisms when they are deserved, and many of them are. But much of it is simply an acting out, an attempt to free oneself, to find oneself, to be a grown-up. So much conspires to prevent their growing up. We've come into a new era, an era where Often we will see young people not earning their livelihood until late in their 20s. We must adjust to this era. We must recognize that we cannot do so as if they were still children. They are full grown, capable of having children of their own, capable of earning a living, of being emotionally and physically responsible for their well-being, and this somehow we must permit them. When a child goes off to college, he ceases to be a child. When he goes off to college, we really cease to be his parents. We become members of a family of equals. Yes, we're father, we're mother, he's son, she's daughter. Yes, we're there with judgment, we're there with advice, we're going to help whenever we're needed. But sometimes less help is better than more. And sometimes being there less is better than being on the phone every night, finding out how darling is doing. Let them be free. Let them be adult. They'll stumble and fall and bloody their noses. We did, God knows. But they'll pick themselves up. They'll make something of themselves. But if we bind them with the silken strings, we permit very little freedom, we treat them as children, they're going to wait for us to pick them up. And we may not always be there. And they may lose ultimately the capacity to pick themselves up again. It's not so bad to grow up in Pepper Pike. The problem is getting out of there. Amen.